The hour of 10:15 having arrived, we'll call the House Tax Committee to order when we have a quorum. We are very fortunate today to have with us Dr. Paul Wilson from the Department of Revenue. And if you could please join us, Doctor. And if you have someone else that's joining you. So we're going to turn it over to you and Dr. Wilson. I think what we'll do is we'll go through your presentation. How do you prefer? Do you prefer to have questions as we go or at the end?
Mr. Chair, it's sort of your call on that. I'm fine either way.
Okay. I think members, it's okay. I'd like to go through an uninterrupted presentation, and then we'll have full time for members' questions. And Dr. Wilson, I will be interrupting when we do have a quorum, just take care of a few official things here. So with that, please state your name and who you represent for the record, please, sir.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Wilson. I'm the Director of Tax Research at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. I'm here today. I also have Philip Anthony here from the Department of Revenue, who's going to be helping me out at least with the slides. I'm not sure if he's going to be answering questions or not, but he may be. So.
Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, it's a pleasure to be here. It feels a little bit like coming home for me. I have good memories of my time here when Representative Abrams was chair, and so it's always nice to come back. Today is, we're presenting the 2015 Minnesota State and Local Tax Incidence Study, its results. I do know there are some new members of the committee who have not seen this before, so I'm going to start a little bit by spending some time on overview before we get to the part that some of you may be more interested in, which is the 2017 projections. This is a very large project. We spent a lot of resources on it. A lot of people in my office work on that, including Phil Anthony, who is here, so that I'm presenting it. But it's six or seven people in the office spent a lot of time on this, and I want to thank them for that. I want to start by just looking at the strengths of the study, what makes this study a good study, a useful study for your committee and others. And then I'll summarize the results for 2012. Thank you. Our base year is 2012 because that's the latest year of complete income tax data that we have at the time of the study. Most of you know that the income tax model works on our income tax sample as well, and you're still using a 2012 year for modeling the income tax as well for bill analyses. Then we'll look at the projections to 2017 and compare them with 2012. I think this is the first year I can remember where anyone is very interested in the projections, but there were a lot of law changes between 2012 and 2017. So this time we'll spend a bit more time on the impact, potential impact of those law changes, to what extent they explain what the differences are between 2012 and 2017. And at the end we'll just give a little bit of historical trends and comparison with some other states to put this in context. The first strength of the study I would emphasize is just that it includes all Minnesota state and local taxes. This is not just state taxes. It's very important given the role of local taxes and how they interact with the state and local system that we look at the entire system together. It's not just the income tax. I know some people like to quote statistics from just the income tax, but this includes sales and other taxes as well, so it's the whole system. It's not just general fund taxes. And because it includes all these taxes, it lets us look at the full tax portfolio that Minnesota has. You think about a choice of a portfolio of taxes. We have a mix of taxes of different sizes and different types, and it's the overall impact of that portfolio on Minnesota residents that we're looking at.
Dr. Wilson, I'm sorry if I could interrupt there. I'll officially call the House Tax Committee meeting to order. Representative Simonson moves the minutes of March 12th. Any additions or corrections? Hearing none, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Motion prevails. Thank you, Dr. Wilson. Please continue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee. So it's all Minnesota state and local taxes, but I must hasten to state that it does not include all the taxes Minnesotans pay. And I know, Mr. Chair, you may have some discussion on this later, questions about this later. We do not include the Minnesota burden of taxes levied by other states. So if there's a corporate tax in another state and you own stock in a corporation that pays that tax, you presumably bear some of the burden of that other state's taxes, and we make no attempt to bring in the taxes levied by other states. In addition, we do not include federal taxes. So, nevertheless, this study includes all the taxes over which this committee has jurisdiction. So state and local taxes in their totality. The second advantage I'd like to, or strength of the study I'd like to mention, is just that it includes all taxes, including business taxes. Not just taxes on individuals, but also taxes on business. This came in with the second of the 13 studies that we have done. And I've got a slide here showing the business taxes. It's important for a couple reasons to look at this list. One is that the definition of a business tax in this study does not depend upon the administration of the tax. It doesn't depend upon who remits the tax. So the tax on cigarettes or alcohol is remitted by businesses. It's not paid by individuals. It's remitted by business. We call that an individual tax because we assume that all of that tax can be passed on higher prices to the consumers. It's not who remits it that matters. A business tax is a tax that has that places a burden on the business that we don't think could be just fully shifted forward to consumers. So if you look at the list here, business property taxes are obviously there. The sales tax on business purchases. So to the extent that businesses pay tax on their purchases, the question is what happens to that burden? Who really bears the burden of that tax? It's not all being shifted forward to consumers in all likelihood. So that's what we mean by business taxes or taxes of that sort. So you have taxes on business property, taxes on insurance that businesses purchase, taxes on vehicles that businesses use, and taxes on consumer taxes that happen to be where businesses happen to be the purchaser of those goods. If you look at the list here, you'll see, first of all, business property taxes are 49% of the total in 2017, and sales taxes are projected to be 30%. The corporate tax is comes in third by quite a bit, lagging behind the other two in terms of total dollars of business taxes. The other thing to notice is that 32% of all the taxes collected by Minnesota are levied on businesses, or the type of taxes we would refer to as business taxes. The next slide shows the taxes on individuals, 68% of the total, and again, to the extent that it includes things like cigarette taxes, it also includes the sales tax extent to their consumer purchases. So the distinction between business and individual taxes is important. For business taxes, we have the problem of deciding who really bears the burden of those taxes. And we've used the same methodology really since the second study. We have to estimate how much of each tax is shifted forward in higher prices, how much is shifted back to workers perhaps in lower wages, how much is borne by the owners as lower profits. And the model that's used to do that, it depends on the nature of the industry. It depends whether they can shift prices forward. Is it really possible? We are looking at long-run incidents, so we're assuming that adjustments have fully taken place. Obviously, if a tax goes up, businesses can't respond immediately in a lot of cases. But we're looking at the long-run impact. 5 or 7 years down the road, what would be likely to be the impact of the tax? Who would likely bear it? At the bottom of that page, we also look at the percentage of the taxes that are exported. Exported meaning they're paid by non-Minnesotans. And the estimate is that in 2017, that 16% of Minnesota's total tax burden is exported or is paid by non-residents, 84% paid by residents. The exported percentage is higher for business taxes at about 39%, and 5.5% for individual taxes. But when we look at burdens, we're only looking at the portion that's borne by Minnesota residents, so we take out that 16% up front. The third strength of the study, I think, is that it's not limited just to income tax filers. We represent the entire population of Minnesota residents, or at least full-year residents, in this study. 11.8% of households don't file income tax returns. And 8% don't file either an income tax return or a property tax refund. Many of these are obviously low income. Many low income seniors are not required to file, given the way taxes are levied on Social Security. So there are a lot of households in Minnesota. If we leave out the 12% basically of the population, we're misrepresenting what the full population looks at. We have a sample that includes detailed income and tax information for each of 109,597 exactly households in 2012. And there's more information on the report about this, but we have information on household income, types of income, and tax information for each of those. household income tax, homeowner property tax, PTR, and motor vehicle registration tax are hard matches directly to the data. Obviously, when you want to know who bears the burden of the sales tax, you can't track that. You can't identify someplace. That has to be estimated, and we use data from the Consumer Expenditure Survey and statistical methods to try to estimate the typical expenditures by, say, a family of four, married couple with two kids with a certain income level, and use that to allocate the consumption taxes to different households. We divide the entire population into 10 groups called deciles. Each of them then has 258,056 households in it, so one-tenth of the households in each. The lowest income decile are those with incomes less than $10,902 for the year. The highest income is those over the 258,056 households with more than $140,692 in 2016. So again, divide the population from lowest income to highest income into 10 equal-sized groups by the count of households. I would make a warning here at the bottom. When we talk about households in this study, it doesn't mean the same thing the census does when the census talks about households. For the census, two single people living together and sharing an apartment are generally counted as one household. But for us, since they'll file separate tax returns, they are considered two households. So we have more households, and we have smaller households. But if you look at the whole population, and again, there's a page number here to look at in the study, our population of people we have covered in the study is the same as what census has. So we're catching everybody, but we're defining a household as basically a tax unit, like a tax hold, but it's like an income tax filing unit with dependents from the end of the household is how we're defining households. And sometimes that means the average income is lower because we've got a lot more single people. The census household income often combines the two people into one household. For us, they're separate, so it brings the average income down in our data. The fourth advantage of the study is that it uses a broad measure of income. You should think about this study as using a measure of income that is essentially the same as the property tax refund or the K-12 credit or the dependent care credit, all of which use a broad definition of income, including non-taxable income. Think of that definition as cash income, basically. We start with federal gross income, but we include non-taxable Social Security and pension income, non-taxable interest income, workers' comp, cash MFIP payments, and voluntary contributions to deferred comp. So it's trying to bring in non-taxable income to get a measure of sort of the true income number of the income level of the individual. However, it does not include some things, and there are studies done at the national level, the Tax Policy Center, Congressional Budget Office, and the U.S. Treasury have models of incidence, and they have a much broader definition of income. We don't include in-kind assistance like food stamps, housing assistance, medical assistance, or Medicare. Some of those other groups try to measure those, estimate that kind of income. We don't include fringe benefits, so the employer-provided health insurance is not counted as income. For us, for those other groups, they do try to impute an estimate of the employer-provided health insurance. Employer pays your Social Security tax on half of Social Security tax. They include that as part of your income as well, and we do not. So there are some differences. We could broaden this. I do think we use a common sense definition of income that most people would say, yeah, that sort of sounds like income. Some of these groups have a hard time explaining to people what they mean by imputed inside buildup in a life insurance policy when they're trying to impute these various kinds of income. But be aware, it's not complete, and it does have its drawbacks.
Well, Dr. Wilson, on that, then we probably should get through the end of it. Well, I'll ask at the end of the presentation.
The fact that in-kind assistance is not included tends to understate income relative to a more inclusive measure at the bottom. But fringe benefits not being included tends to understate income for the middle and upper middle class by more than for the lower income groups. So except at the very top, where I think there clearly would be a difference, it's not clear, and you could, I've got some sources you can look at where it looks like all incomes are sort of unstated. The more inclusive measures sort of raise everybody's income by about 10 to 15% above what they are, at least by decile. Here are the results for 2012. Now, again, we've divided people into deciles, and so on the on the vertical axis, all of our results are effective tax rates. And an effective tax rate is simply total tax burden divided by your income. What share of your income do you pay in taxes, basically? So effective tax rate is just income divided by, I'm sorry, tax burden divided by income. The vertical axis here is taxes percent of income, so effective tax rates are the height here. The horizontal axis are the deciles. So on the left, the first decile with an effective tax rate of 28.3% is the poorest 10% of the population of households. And on the right-hand side, the 10th decile with populations over 141, income over 141,000 is the 10th decile. We also show the top 5% and top 1%, and have done that for, I think, beginning maybe from the very first study, if not for the second or third. So keep in mind the top 5% is in the top decile. The top 1% is in both the top 5% and the top decile. So these are not separate groups, but rather overlapping groups. If you look at this, you'll notice a couple of things right away. First of all, the first decile, 28.3%. Are you kidding? And if you look at the next slide, I'm going to just stay here. If you look at the next slide, you'll see we do have an explanation. We basically tell people disregard the first decile. And we do that because there are reasons to believe the estimate is overstated. To some extent, this is a valid measure. There are 10,600 households in that first decile that have negative incomes, negative federal gross incomes, averaging $150,000 negative dollars. Now, if you have $150,000 negative dollars and you pay any tax, you know, what's your effective tax rate? Well, it's either infinite or it's more than infinite. I'm not quite sure how you deal with a negative number. If you have no income and you pay any tax, you have an infinite effective tax rate. They account for quite a bit of the tax burden down there because we give some of those people business tax burdens because of their business losses and their claimed appreciation. We know they have assets, and so they bear some of the burdens of some of the business taxes. So part of this is real, but it's sort of artificial because it has to do with business losses. On the other hand, we know that we probably are understating income in some of those cases, and the consumer expenditure survey data at the very bottom is also somewhat questionable. So our basic story here is disregard the first decile in what we do. If you look at it, then the next thing you'll notice is the dip in the third and fourth decile. The dip in the third and fourth decile has not been there. Third and fourth decile have not been below the average. The average effective tax rate at the top here you see is 11.5% in 2012. 11.5% of income paid in state burden of state and local taxes in Minnesota state and local taxes. This is the first time since 2004 that the third and fourth deciles have both been at or below the overall average. That dip used to be there. It sort of disappeared for a while. It's back again. A lot of that is because the expansion of the property tax refund is part of the expansion of the working family credit came later, so that's not really part of this. But this is noteworthy. If you go further right there, you see a long flat section in the fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth deciles where it's almost the same tax rate, a proportional system, and then it drops off fairly dramatically at the top. Well, maybe not dramatically, but it drops off at the top between the ninth and the tenth decile. Go ahead. We're going to go one more. We skip the first decile problem, which we've already dismissed. Question about progressivity and regressivity. Now, I know progressive sounds positive and regressive sounds negative, and that is sort of in the eye of the beholder, but these are technical terms, okay? A progressive tax is one where the effective tax rate goes up as income goes up. In terms of the graph, if this line is sloping upward, it's progressive. So if it's going up, if it's uphill going from left to right, it's a progressive tax. If it's going downhill, so the effective tax rate is lower, the higher income you go, it's a regressive tax. If it were a horizontal line, it's a proportional tax because everyone would be paying exactly the same percent of their income in taxes. Now, if you look at that picture, what is that? It's got a little bit of progressivity between third and fourth and fifths. It's got some regressivity at the top. It's got some proportional in the middle. What is the overall? And we use the Suits Index. We use the Suits Index as a simple measure that tries to sort of say, overall, what is this? And the Suits Index, by the way, is mandated that we use that in the statute, so it's sort of interesting that we didn't just come up with this measure, but if you look at the actual statute, it says using Suits Index or similar. Suits Index is a number between minus 1 and plus 1. minus one meet, would, you'd only get to minus one if the poorest household were paying all of the tax. And you only get to plus one if the richest household is paying all of the tax. So plus one is progressive, meaning, but to get to that extreme, you've got to have the richest person paying all of the tax. A zero is proportional. So if you have something where everyone's paying exactly the same percent of their income, that would be a zero for Suits Index. And this scale, then, between minus one and plus one, negatives being regressive, positives being progressive, is a scale we use a lot in the study to look at different taxes and what their effects are. The overall tax Suits Index on this is minus 0.052. Okay? It says here somewhat regressive. It's somewhat is sort of a hard term. It's regressive. It's not. It looks like a small number, but it's very hard to move it. And when we look at 2017, you'll see how hard it is to move that number a little bit. So don't get misled by the smallness of these numbers to think that somehow that's really close to zero, because actually minus 0.052 is not all that close to zero. But it does show you that the downward slope in the, between the ninth and the tenth decile, that's what's driving the number in terms of the overall Suits Index. First decile has almost no impact on this. It's the tenth decile that's driving these results much more to make it somewhat regressive. Okay. So those results for 2012. I think it's useful to think about the tax portfolio. And this is a new diagram this year, I'm so proud of Mary Buechner for being able to create this. It's not perfect, but it was actually a lot of work. But this is a graph that tries to picture the portfolio of Minnesota taxes. The size of the balloons is the dollars of tax burden from that tax on Minnesotans. So the size of the balloons, the bigger balloons rise, so they're higher. Okay. On the horizontal axis, you have the Suits Index, which is a measure of regressive progressivity, zero being proportional. So the further away to the right you are, the more progressive. The further left you are, the more regressive the tax. And a couple of things stand out in this diagram. First of all, the income tax is huge. Mm-hmm. And it's the only big progressive tax in the system. This suggests that if you don't have an income tax in your state, you're going to have a progressive system, because you don't have anything to outweigh the others. The other thing is there are two other progressive taxes that are progressive balloons that are smaller. The estate tax is the most progressive tax by our estimates, but it's pretty small here. And the property tax refund is a very large negative tax, which has a very progressive impact. So if you think of this as sort of like a seesaw, you know that the further you are from the fulcrum, the center, the more a small weight matters. Okay, so if you're way off to one extreme or the other, you matter in terms of the overall suits of the system. If you're big but right in the middle, you don't make much difference, because you're just sitting in the middle of the seesaw and you're not moving it much. There are so that the estate tax and the property tax refund on the right-hand side make quite a difference. On the left-hand side, you can see the tobacco taxes are the most regressive. You look at Minnesota Care, insurance taxes, motor fuels, gambling, solid waste, and tobacco are sort of the ones the furthest to the left, the most regressive taxes we have. Many of them are pretty small. Of the large taxes, the sales tax is more regressive than property taxes, and these are property taxes before PTR. After PTR, that's even more true. And we'll see more of that. There are two taxes that are almost proportional. Motor vehicle sales tax and mortgage and deed tax tend to be close to a zero. They're regressive, but relatively less regressive. Anyway, I think it's a useful picture. So this is the whole thing. If you look at this, where we are in the total system, that minus 0.052 is a weighted average of these, where the weight is the size of the balloon, and it's sort of deciding where are we on average in the system. Where's the center of gravity, if you like? And it's slightly to the left of the zero line. Anyway, for what it's worth, I thought it was a beautiful graph, so I had to include it.
Dr. Wilson, that's a very nice graph.
Okay, thank you. I'll pass that along. Another way to look at what makes the 2012 system to what it is to build these sort of break all taxes into five parts, and then build them one by one, add them one by one to the tax system. So that's what I'm going to do here. You only have slide 14. You have the final slide. I'm going to build them up by pieces so that you can see the individual pieces. I know the numbers are really small on this for some to read, but nevertheless. The first piece is the income tax. The income tax is 36% of the total burden in 2012, And it's progressive. You can tell it's progressive because the line is upward sloping. You go from a negative tax in the bottom two deciles because refundable credits offset any tax due and they actually have a negative income tax to 5.5% in the top decile. So a very progressive element to our tax structure, more progressive actually than most income tax systems at the state level. So this is the starting point. If we then add on property taxes, what you'll notice with the property, this is not really property tax, this is residential property tax after PTR. So include PTR in it. What's the net effect on residential property taxes? This does have cabins in it as well, but it doesn't make much effect if you take them out. But they're in here because I don't know where, where else. This residential property tax, 8%, I'm sorry, 19% of the total tax burden in Minnesota. And you'll notice it goes from 1.8% in the second decile up to 3% in the sixth. So in sixth decile, people are paying 3% of their income in residential property taxes, net of property tax refund. And then it drops down to 1.6% in the top decile. This includes rental properties, so this is the burden of rental for renters as well as homeowners, but both net of property tax refunds. If we stack the next group, I should mention the suits index for the residential property tax at minus 1.159 is regressive, but not as regressive as we'll see as the sales tax, which comes next. So look at the sales tax. Now you're going from 5.8% in the second decile to 1.5% at the top. Now you're really seeing the system level out quite a bit. We started with a progressive income tax. We've added now regressive taxes on top of it. And if we add the last group, which is everything else. Now, everything else does include the estate tax, but it includes mostly consumption taxes, which are pretty regressive. And so if you look at that, that's your total effect. But state and local sales taxes and all the other taxes have suits indexes of minus 0.254, minus 0.258, very regressive. And that's what's pulling the system so that it looks like it does there for the totals. So there's your graph, the one you have in your packet, with numbers on that probably are almost illegible. But okay, that's a picture of where things come from. When you build these things up, you can look at the components. I think it's useful to think about the whole tax portfolio because it's the overall system that matters, not any single tax. One final comment on 2012 before I look at the impact of moving to the projections of 2017. I want to just emphasize, we have a section in Chapter 4 that talks about the impact of refundable credits and the impact of, refundable income tax credits. This is the working family credit primarily, the K-12 credit, and the child dependent care credit, and the property tax refunds. And so this graph here, this chart shows you the impact of the refundable income tax credits. And what it's just basically showing is if you actually have in law is the red line. If you got rid of those, if you repealed them all, a couple states have taken that direction lately, repealed them all, the income tax would look like the blue line and would be quite a bit less progressive at the bottom. So they have a major impact. The overall suits index for this income tax gets quite a bit more regressive. Less progressive if you were to get rid of those credits. They play a very big role in the overall picture. And the same thing is true of property tax refunds. On this graph, I don't have cabins in here, you'll see the note, but this is rental property and homeowners combined. This is 2012, so it's before the expansion that occurred in 2013 in the property tax refunds. But even here, you can see the major impact. We said that the residential property taxes go up between the second and the fifth decile, fifth or sixth decile. They would not do that if we didn't have the property tax refund. So the property tax refund has a large impact, again, on the overall impact, the overall regressivity, progressivity of the entire tax system. And again, it's sometimes handy to have a place to look to sort of say, this is the role they play. All right, what happened between 2012 and 2017? We had two legislative sessions, 2013 and 2014, that are not reflected in the 2012 results. And so now we're looking at law changes as well as economic growth. Between 2012 and 2017, there was quite a bit of economic growth. Incomes are projected to be up 25%. So this is we're looking at growth, and that has an impact by itself, and then we're looking at law changes as well. I want to look at this. This graph, though, if you look at it really carefully, you can tell that every decile is going down. The red line is below the blue line on every decile except for the top decile. but it's really hard to see it. Now, I'm one of these people that really hates people who change the axes of graphs so that they show more exaggeration. But in this case, it probably, so I'm sort of apologizing, but I think you got to do it. So the next graphic just takes that and says, let's just change the vertical axis and make it 9% to 13 instead of 0 to 30. Let's shrink it. I can't show the first decile anymore, but we started to disregard that anyway. Let's look at what the impact is. And here you can really see the changes. You can see that at the bottom, you have drops of 0.8 percentage point and 0.6 percentage point of income. So these are large drops at the second and the third deciles, and basically a drop of about 0.2 percentage points going forward in the others on average. And then at the very top, the top decile had its tax rate go up, but not go down, but go up by 0.2% of the income. And the increases in the top 5 and top 1% are even larger. If you look at this, I mean, at least when it's magnified this way, it looks significant. I would say it really is significant. This is a major change in the structure of taxes. This is it's hard sometimes to know what big and small are, but if you look at what it takes to move these things around, this is a fairly significant change. The Suits Index said, and I'm not sure I have it on here, but it was minus 0.052 before, now it's minus 0.035. All right, minus 0.052 to minus 0.035, moving towards zero, but it didn't get there. We're not proportional. We still have the drop at the top that causes it to have a regressive or a Suits Index that's negative. But it certainly is different than 2012. And again, it takes a lot to move these things. So I want to look at the reasons. Why? Can we explain what's going on here? I would say that this gets us back to close to where we were between 1998 and 2004 in terms of the Suits Index. 1996 was much, much less regressive. But since 2006, we have been quite a bit more regressive. It's been more like 2012. So this is an unusual shift in that sense. The next slide shows one starting point for explaining what's going on, which is local government. This is the local government share of Minnesota state and local tax revenues taken from our studies. And just remember some history here. Local property taxes used to be, or local government, almost all property taxes used to be over 30% of the state and local tax revenue. They dropped to a low of in 2002 of 24.6%, and you know why that is, right? That was the takeover of the reform, the takeover of K-12 education with the state money. And then it rose a little bit, and it went all the way back up to 31.5% in 2010. It came down a bit in 2012. It's predicted to continue to go down. Now, why is that important? Well, that's important because the property tax is less regressive than a lot of other taxes. But it's still regressive, okay? And so when you look at that, it's not the property taxes going down, they're just not going up nearly as fast as income. On the next page, we look at the residential property tax burdens, and this is the change in the effective tax rate. Let me just think about the numbers here first of all, because it's a little it's easy to be confused here. This is the change in effective tax rate between 12 and 17 for just residential property taxes. And you'll see they're all negative. The total there says it went down by 0.3%. Now, that doesn't mean it went down by, it means it went down by 0.3% of income. It went down from 2.2% of income to 1.9% of income. Okay, so it went from 2.2% of income to 1.9% of income. It dropped by 0.3% of income. These are substantial drops in residential property taxes. Why did they go down? You see they went down for everybody. If you look at the reason on the right-hand side, between 2012 and 2017, income is expected to rise by 25% based on the forecast, but residential property taxes are forecast to rise by only 10%. Homesteads by 9%, rental property by 15%. The PTR is forecast to rise by 27%, mainly because of expansions in 2013. But partly because rental property rents are going up as well. But 27% for renters and 40% for homeowners. So if you have residential property tax after PTR going up by only 6% and income is going up by 25%, when you look at the ratio of tax to income, your income's up 25%, your tax is only going up 6%, you're going to see the effective tax rate fall pretty dramatically, and that's what's going on here. So one reason why the effective tax rate is dropping a bit, what's pulling it down is primarily residential property taxes. Now, I would say that this is a projection for 17. I did go talk to our property tax people and said, oh, really? Are you sure? And they said, yes, that's what's in the forecast. Now, this is the price of government forecast, but so it's a little hard to know, but still, this is based on the forecast. So if, in fact, that happens, this brings effective tax rates down by itself considerably. What about income tax? Income tax burdens are going the other direction, okay? What you'll see is that it's the same kind of a graphic here, same kind of a chart. The total income tax burden went down, is going up by 0.4% of income, going from 4.1% of income to 4.5% of income. So that's an increase of 0.4% of income. And it's going up across the board, I mean, pretty much, except for the first three death laws, where the expansion of working family credit pretty much wiped out the increase in income tax down there. But you've got, starting with the fourth decile, you've got 0.3% of income increase, 0.23. They're almost all between 0.25 and 0.26, and they round a little differently, but they're almost all relatively sort of close to the same percentages until you get to the tenth decile when it rises more. And what's bringing about this about? Between 2017 and 2012 and 2017, income is expected to rise by 25%, as we said. Inflation is expected to be only 7.3% in the forecast between those five years. And population growth about 5%. So the average inflation-adjusted income per household is expected to rise by about 10.5%. Now, that's an increase in income above inflation. If income rises by more than inflation, effective tax rates tend to rise. And they tend to rise without any change in tax law because your real income is higher. Income tax brackets are indexed for inflation, but they're not indexed for real growth in income. They're just indexed for inflation. So when you have higher growth, a higher portion of your income is subject to tax. A higher portion of your income is subject to tax in your tax top tax bracket. You don't have to go into, it's not going to take you to a higher tax bracket. That's not what's going on here. It's just simply changing your tax. And these are the results primarily. That 0.2% is basically the result of that. This is simply growth. This is the automatic impact of economic growth with incomes rising faster than inflation and our income tax system. This is true through the first half of the 10th decile, where it's also 0.2%. It's only the top 5% and top 1% where you see larger increases, and that's, of course, the added fourth tier tax rate driving that. So income taxes are up, property taxes, residential property taxes are down. If we look at the rest of it here, we've got a couple of different categories. This repeats the residential property tax and personal income tax, and then it adds state and local sales tax and others. State and local sales taxes, the revenue went up by a little under 22%. Motor vehicle sales tax was very strong, up 40%, but the sales tax, general sales tax, up only about 20%. So it went up more slowly than income. And when, again, tax goes up more slowly than income, then your tax divided by income ratio is going to go down. And so state and local sales taxes, you'll see all of those are negative. They round to zero, but they're all negative numbers. And they're basically proportional. Everybody's sales tax burden is going down. It's just going down proportionally. So it goes down from 2.4% to 2.3% overall. But if you have a higher effective tax rate at the bottom, it's going to go down by a larger percent of income, but it's proportional changes all the way down. Not a huge change, but it's driving part of it. And the all other taxes category, you've got the cigarette tax increase maybe driving some of that increase at the bottom, although it's not showing up much there, but to some extent. At the very top, that top 1%, I'm sure that decrease of 0.2% is affected by the estate tax cuts. But otherwise, the other taxes are sort of noise in terms of the overall impact. But the right-hand side, you see the result. Taxes have gone down for every decile except for the top decile. And in all likelihood, although they didn't actually measure it, the first half of that decile is probably it's probably not changing much. But the top 5%, top 1% are going up. And the overall tax rate is going down from 11.5% to 11.4%. Okay, can we explain that? We've done said that some of this explanation is just economic growth, but how much is due to law changes? And I just want to go through this very quickly. Just these are discussed in the text in the report. But I want to talk about five law changes and just what their impact is. And here I'm going to focus on the Suits Index as what we're trying to explain. How can we explain the change in the Suits Index from minus 0.05 to minus 0.035? How much of that is due to law change? The fourth income tax bracket change raised taxes by about $600 million in 2017. And that's a tax increase that is concentrated at the very top of the income distribution. It has a Suits Index for the law change of plus 0.813, okay? So it's an extremely progressive increase in structure of the taxes. By itself, it would raise the Suits Index by plus 0.020. Okay, now that's why I say it takes a lot to move the Suits Index. Think about that. Fourth tier tax bracket, $600 million increase on the very top income portion of the population, and only changes Suits Index by 0.02. So it takes a lot to move that index. Just keep that in mind. We go down to the other one, the expanded working family credit. Expanded working family credit is small, $34 million, but again, it's concentrated among those at the very bottom, and so that probably raised the Suits Index by itself by 0.001. If we look at expanded PTR, that's bigger, $145 million decrease in taxes, concentrated at least at the lower end and not necessarily at the bottom, because a lot of that was homeowners raising the eligibility of the PTR for homeowners higher up. But that probably increases the Suits Index by plus 0.004. On the other hand, there were two changes that were very regressive. The tobacco tax increases, cigarette tax increase of about $200 million has a very regressive Suits Index, minus 0.614. It's the most regressive tax. Remember, that by itself would reduce the Suits Index more regressivity by 0.005 and reduce the state taxes, although it's a relatively small amount compared to some of the others. Again, it's concentrated at the very top, and so it again would change the Suits Index, making it more regressive by 0.002 overall. Now, if you just add these things up, you've got a $551 million net impact. You've got a plus 0.018, and you can, in fact, add Suits Indexes like this. That's one of the advantages of using a Suits Index, is the way it interacts with these changes. And what was our change? The change was plus 0.017, and we've explained plus 0.018 of the plus 0.017. In other words, it looks like most of what happened between 12 and 17 was due to law changes. Now, it's hard to really say that, but I would say law changes at least are very important in what happened, so that while economic growth had the effect of other things changing, if you hadn't had these law changes, you presumably would have had very little change in the Suits Index, very little change in the distribution of the tax burden overall. If you hadn't had these tax changes, the overall tax rate would be a little bit lower as well, but it would be more regressive, sort of where we were in 2012. Just a couple other comments on sort of historical overview. This is the average effective tax rate since 1990. You know, 11.5 in 2012, 11.4 in 2017 doesn't look too surprising. This is not there's nothing real groundbreaking here in terms of effective tax rates. We are lower effective tax rates than in the 90s, but since then it's been in a fairly narrow range. And the next slide just shows Suits Indexes. Now, Suits Indexes, we had an old measure of Suits Index using population groups. We only had 10 groups of households. Now we use every household to calculate this. So the dark ones are the better measures, but we have the historic. We can't go back and redo these things historically. And so we've got two series. But you can see the pattern no matter which ones you look at. When we started the studies, our tax system was almost proportional. Suits Index is very close to zero, minus 0.017, minus 0.011. We got increased regressivity in 96 and 98, in 98 and 2000. In 2002, with the recession, we moved back toward almost proportional. And then starting in 2006, we've had a fairly regressive tax system relative to history. In other words, you know how much it takes to change these now, so you can sort of see these changes are significant. The shift in 2017 is, you know, from 0.052 to 0.036 is noticeable. Okay, it takes us back pretty much to the average between 1998 and 2004. Okay. Just want to make one other comment about other states. There are very few other states that do studies. Maryland actually has done an incident study in 2010. They did a study for tax year 2004. In 2011, in December, they published one for 2006. I think they're not doing the next one, but I don't. You haven't heard anything else. I don't think they're continuing that process. The person that was doing them left. And so I don't know if they're continuing or not, but they work with us a lot trying to figure out how to do this because it's a big job. I don't believe they ended up including property taxes in the end. Connecticut did a study in 2014, just came out for tax year 2011. They hired a consultant who worked with us, and the consultant is now selling a Minnesota-style tax incident study to any state that wants it. So you may see a growth in a growth industry here. We'll see how successful ChangeBridge Associates, ChangeBridge LLC is.
Dr. Wilson, how are sales going?
I don't know. I know they're hopeful.
Yes.
They're marketing very strongly.
Now we get like a 10% commission? Or?
Unfortunately, no. We do use one of their products, so we're hoping they're nice to us about that product. So our consumption tax model is made by the same people. There is one study of all 50 states. The study is done by the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy, which is affiliated with Citizens for Tax Justice. This is the only study of all 50 state incidents that's out there, and my knowledge of the people that work on it and the work they do is it's a quality study. Its methodology is pretty close to what ours is. It comes out with results that are believable, so I know there may be some question about the affiliation of the group, but the work that they do on this study, I think, is strong enough that we thought, given the interest of sort of where things stand in other states, it was worth including it since there was no other way to do this. Their study estimates the distribution of the burden for all 50 states of all state and local taxes. They limit it to non-senior households because the senior households are hard to model when you're looking at state laws. They use a methodology similar to ours but based on more limited data, obviously. They don't use deciles or suits indexes. We'll see it. They basically estimate effective tax rates for 7 groups in each state, and we'll see that in the next slide. And then we calculate, and I should say, since Jeff Van Wyken is here, he helps us calculate and report a 7-point suits index. In other words, we have 7 points, and we can estimate a suits index based upon those 7 points like we did our old 10-point population suits indexes for each state for comparison purposes. But that's actually our calculation, not the study, not the ITEP's calculation. And I just wanted to show you a couple graphs just because I think it's interesting, and if you ever have questions about where the states are, I think there's at least a starting point for those. This is Minnesota in red. What you'll notice is they don't have our first decile, but the pattern otherwise is fairly similar. Their groups are the lowest 20%, the second 20%, the middle 20%, the fourth 20%, and then the next 15, the next 4, and the next 1. So it's sort of like our top 5 and top 1 at the right-hand side. So it's groups that are a bit more condensed, but same kind of a pattern. And for Minnesota, they get a suits index of minus 0.015. Now, if I do ours for non-seniors only, I get minus 0.029. It's not that much different, but clearly it's different. It's not the same kind of a result. This slide just compares our pattern, which I think is similar to what we would show here. And this would take into effect, by the way, the tax law changes in 13 and 14 to the extent that they, because this is basically using the current tax law put out last fall, I think. But you see our pattern. If you compare us to Washington, Texas, or Florida, you know, those are the states without income taxes, and you can sort of see what their patterns look like compared to what ours look like in their study. And the last slide that I have here shows our neighboring states. Again, if you look at our neighboring states, Wisconsin and Iowa have systems that are less regressive than average among states. We are the 7th least regressive state. They are, I think, 15th and 18th, but by the suits index measure. And there's a table in our study of every state. But they're fairly similar to us. I'm intrigued by the fact that Wisconsin's higher than us in all except the top 5%. But I wouldn't. Given the differences in methodology, I'm not sure how much to count on that. But anyway, if anybody notices that, that's what it's showing. The other two states, South Dakota and North Dakota, obviously South Dakota with no income tax is quite a bit more regressive. So, again, the The study we do, it looks at 2012 with some detail. I must admit, the projections of 2017 that we show here, we've never been real comfortable with projections because they're very tough to do and they always have to be done at the last minute. So projection is there's more noise in the projection certainly, but it is based on the forecast and it's sort of what we can do. And everybody says, but if we put out a 2012 report, everybody says, well, that's ancient history. So, and it really is when you've had as much law change as you've had. So the projections are useful, and I think that there's a lot to be learned from them. And I thank you, and we'll take any questions, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson. I've got a couple questions, then we'll go to member questions here. But before we do that, tomorrow's agenda, we have several House Files, 167, an ordinance bill, House File 263, a Peterson bill, 532, a Petersburg bill, 1829, a Knobloch bill, and 416, an Ansel's bill. So that's for tomorrow. With the bill I'm carrying on the gas tax increases on behalf of Governor Dayton, how much would that change the indexes if that was fully implemented in the law with the 6.5% tax on the wholesale price?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I must admit that I have not done that, but you can, if you take that increase, and it's not a hard calculation to do, if you just assume that tax is going to be just the same regressivity as the motor fuels tax, it's a fairly straightforward calculation to see what it would do with the suits, to the suits index at least. So we can do that. We can do that work, but we have not done it at this point.
Okay.
Clearly, it's a regressive tax, so if regressivity is what you're looking at, that's what it would show.
In 2011, I think it was a Garofalo amendment in the tax bill that included federal income taxes, and then that was taken out in, I think, 13. If that was put back in, what effect would that have on the suits index?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, if I can answer that question in two ways. Let me answer what it would do first, but if you allow me to make a few comments about it, too, afterward. I think there's no doubt that if you brought federal taxes, I'm not sure about other state taxes, and that's a different issue. If you just brought federal taxes into the study, federal taxes are higher than state and local taxes. Federal taxes are quite progressive overall, despite the Social Security tax being capped and being based on wages. And so I'm fairly confident that overall you would end up with the total system with federal and Minnesota state and local, if you disregard the other states, would almost certainly be progressive to some extent, suits index greater than zero.
Okay. You mentioned, Dr. Wilson, the imputed income in the cash values of life insurance. Now, was that included or not included?
Mr. Chair, we do not do anything that complicated. this is the kind of thing that's done in the U.S. Treasury model, in the Congressional Budget Office model, in the Tax Policy Center's model. They try to get a better measure of total income. And I think particularly if you're looking at major tax reform proposals, you almost have to do that because you're going to change things that will change the definition of income. So I think at the federal level, it's extremely important. Trying to impute these things at the state level, we've never done it. We've never tried to do it. The value of doing it, I think, is, given the use of the report here, is probably limited.
But Dr. Wilson, wouldn't that be very small anyways, in that the cash values of life insurance aren't taxable as long as they're left there? The only way would be if you were cashing in contracts, I suppose, but that'd be very minimal, I would think.
Mr. Chair, by imputed, we mean that they estimate what it is when it's going up in value and not cashed in. So they're estimating what the increase in the value of it is every year, and they're actually imputing that as imputed income to individuals in their sample.
But why would you do that, Dr. Wilson? Because that's not going to be income down the road anyways. The whole point is you're dead.
unless it's whole life and you just decide to take it out for your own use. Some of the other imputations are large, though. I mean, the imputation of the value of employer-provided health insurance or employer contributions to retirement funds is large. So some of those imputations are very large. You're right, that particular one would not be particularly significant.
Okay. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I have just a question about non-residential property taxes. It is a fairly large bubble on your pretty chart here as well. And it, you put it at, as slightly regressive, but I'm just having a hard time getting a handle around what that actually is. It sounds to me like it's property taxes that are paid by non-Minnesota residents. And if that's the case, then how does that apply to their tax rate when it's not part of Minnesota residents paying for it? So I'm a little, maybe you can clarify that for me. Appreciate that. John.
Dr. Peterson. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative. Non-residential property taxes means everything except for apartments and homes and cabins. So it's the taxes on manufacturing, commercial property, on farms, farmland, and on some other categories of our property. But it basically, think of it as commercial industrial utility property as primarily what that is, and farm. It's not that they're not Minnesota residents, it's that it's property that is business property but not to be lived in.
I see. I understand. Thanks.
Right. Representative Garofalo, Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. A couple of questions. First of all, with regards to the interaction with federal tax policy, I know that there are federal changes that can impact tax liability at the state level. Are those automatically assumed in the tax incident study?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, there are a lot of changes at the local level that can affect federal taxes. We don't allow a deduction for federal taxes, so I'm having a little trouble figuring out where you'd have a federal change that would affect the state tax. If they change a definition of income and we conform to it, that would then change state tax as well, but that would be our choice to conform to it. Those would certainly be one example.
Chair Groffel.
And Mr. Chairman, Dr. Wilson, so like, for example, there was a quirk in tax law a while back where capital gains taxes were projected to go up. Federal government was going to have a higher capital gains tax rate, so mm-hmm. everyone took their capital gains in an earlier year. That's the sort of thing. Are those taken into account with the tax incident study?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, we look at the actual taxes paid. So if it's an income tax, if it's a change in the actual income tax paid, that's what we're modeling. Okay. So to the extent that somebody realized income taxes, capital gains earlier in 2012, that shows up. And 2012 was a very high year for capital gains. I think it was the highest year for dollars of capital gains that we've had, although as a proportion of income, it was quite a bit lower than 1998 or 2000. So 2012 is somewhat unusual because of the high capital gains income that year. In our projection out to 2017, and it was largely because of what you were talking about, the shifting because of expected federal law changes. In 2017, we expect the forecast for capital gains 2017 is almost the same as in 12 in dollars. So that clearly does have an effect on the overall incidence of the study.
Chair Groffel.
Mr. Chairman, and thank you. And Dr. Wilson, with regards to the tax incident study, does it measure volatility? I think that there's a general, I don't think there's much controversy in the fact that we are now relying on a greater proportion of our tax revenue from a smaller and smaller number of tax filers. Do we have a measurement of that in this tax incident study or in another report?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Garofalo, the incident study does not include anything other than the incidence of taxes. There is a paragraph in there that says that when you look at the tax portfolio, you've got to look at, there are obviously other goals than just regressive progressivity. And so there are trade-offs to be faced there, and those goals include things like stability. The place for stability, to look for stability, though, there was a Budget Trends Commission a few years back that did a lot of work on volatility. What they basically concluded is that to change tax structure to make revenue less volatile from then would have been such a major change that it would probably not be acceptable based on other goals. And they said their basic recommendation was you've got to fix the budgeting process so that it doesn't just use money when it comes in and then not have it. In other words, try to use the budget policy to smooth things out rather than trying to get the revenue systems stable. But But that's the only source I know, and the best source I know of sure. Because they did some real work on volatility of different taxes.
Mr. Chairman, my final my final comment, I guess, quasi question is, I guess, I think the response to that was that there was recognition that if you went to a broader base where you had more stable and predictable revenue, the consequences of that is that you're actually going to make the tax code more regressive because you have more people paying. Whereas the choices that were made the last 2 years is to have fewer people pay taxes, but now we've introduced increased volatility into our revenue system. And the response to that was to make the budget reserve larger and to have more money in savings at the state basis. But members should be under no illusions about what happened the last 2 years, regressive or progressive. We are having a smaller number of tax filers provide a huge amount of revenue to the tax code, and basically what we've done is we have magnified and concentrated the effects of the income tax in our revenue system. So if the stock market's going up, if the economy's growing, we are going to have more money than we expected. But when we have a recession, and I expect at some point in the future we will have a recession, we're going to feel it a lot harder than other states are. That's the consequences of the decision that we made. And when that happens, it will be something that we're all going to have to live with. Thank you.
Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Wilson, I just want to make sure I've got two questions. The first one is on page 21 of your handout. You had mentioned that income taxes are going up across the board, and it looks like it here from the chart that you have. But I just want to verify that I heard you correctly, that we're expecting to see them go up.
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, the effective tax rates for income tax are going up between 2012 and 2017 because of economic growth. Obviously, there's been no change in tax rates at all. Income tax revenue is going up faster than income is going up, and so the effective tax rates go up. But the only place where your tax law change has any significant impact is the bottom is the working family credit changes, and at the top would be the fourth tier in the top 5%. The other increases are due just simply to the impact of economic growth with no changes in tax rates at all.
And Mr.
Chair Anderson S.
And Mr. Wilson, talking about that fourth tier, we have many folks that are pass-through entities where they're taking their business income and passing that through their income tax. Is that counted as part of the income, or is that counted as business income? So how did you parse that out in determining regressivity, progressivity of Minnesota?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson. It's a good question that we've thought about some. We talk about business income, and you'll notice that on that business income list, it did not include any income tax. So we assume, as everyone else does that I know of that's done tax incidence work at the federal level, for example, we assume that the taxes on flow-through entities like the taxes on dividends from stock and other things, that is basically borne by the owner of by the owners of the business, by the stockholders or by the partners. There are some studies out there. I know that studies that are done by Ernst & Young do include in their definition of business taxes the tax on flow-through income entities or sole proprietors as well as the others. I'm not at all sure how we would think through how to allocate that even if we did it, because the information that we use for the other taxes is just not there for those entities anyway. And my guess is that given the local nature of S-corps and partnerships a lot of them are much more local in terms of their ownership, and so the effect of that is quite a bit different than it is on the larger corporations. But it's a good question, but we do not, we just assume that the income that they earn is income, and the tax they pay on that income is tax that they pay.
Chair Chair Anderson S.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilson, I understand the struggle that you're faced with in trying to decide how to do that, but I think that we have heard time and again from business owners that have come here and said that's income that they put back into their business and invest into their business, whether it's doing infrastructure, whether it's hiring another person for their business, and so forth. So I think that we're missing a component when we're looking at this study, especially with the fourth tier hitting a large portion of those folks that have pass-through income that they're running through their personal income taxes, that maybe this isn't giving us a clear picture overall of what the effective tax rates are for Minnesota and what you know, giving us an accurate picture of what we can expect and the regressivity of our tax system overall. And I think it would be interesting to see if we put that component in, how much that would change everything that we're looking at here today. But thanks, Mr. Chair.
If I could reply just a little bit to that, I would say that we're looking at tax as a percent of income. If you were to say, as we do with the others, that well, some of this tax, what we would do is if we included it, we'd say, well, some of this tax is actually passed forward to consumers in higher prices. And some of this tax may be reflected in lower wages, but in a lot of these cases, the lower wages would be the owners anyway, to a large extent. I mean, a lot of these limited liability corporations are groups of lawyers, groups of, I mean, I know there's all kinds of S corps and partnerships, but you've got a lot of those entities where it would be very hard, where it wouldn't make any difference basically. I don't hear the groups talking about the impact saying that, well, we can just pass this on to consumers anyway in higher prices. That's not the argument that I'm hearing. And if we were to bring it into the incident study, that would be the kind of question we'd be asking. It would still be income. The question would just be, in fact, does that get passed on to consumers, or does it get, I mean, so that's the question. And I don't know exactly how it would change the results, but it would probably not change them in the direction that you were thinking. It would maybe be the opposite direction of their impact.
Chair Anderson S.
Well, Mr. Chair and Mr. Wilson, I can't remember what the study was. I actually thought it was a study that you had done, but I remember the paragraph talking about that it is results in lower wages and results in higher consumer prices and things of that nature. I'll have to go back through my notes to see, but obviously that does play a huge impact on Minnesotans, and I think that's something that we need to have as part of the conversation when we're developing tax policy.
Thank you. Chair Lincheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Dr. Wilson, for being with us today. Just thinking about, there's just so much information in this, you know, every time it's produced, that it's just so helpful, and we are so lucky in Minnesota, Mr. Chair, to have the Department of Revenue and nonpartisan people who look at this work, and we really are the model for most states who wish their legislatures would require these studies. So thank you, Mr. Chair, for having the hearing on this report. And, you know, I just have a couple questions, but, you know, one thing I noticed, Mr. Chair, I think you have a bill this year to bring back the Garofalo bill that we just talked about of the federal incidents again, and you know, I agree that the federal system would make things more progressive, but you'd have to apply that to every single state then in comparing states, because it would have the same effect really for all states by adding the tax incidence of the federal government. And I wish I could tell Representative Paulson, who's a former member of this committee in Congress, he's my congressman, and Senator Klobuchar what to do about federal taxes, but I don't think we're going to change the federal tax code from this room. So I hope you'll think about that going forward. But, you know, in thinking about the comments, you know, that have been made thus far from members, this is just asking who pays. It isn't adequacy. It's not stability. It's not volatility. That's not what this study sets out to do. And, you know, we've certainly looked at those things, too. But, you know, Representative Garofalo is right by saying, you know, hey, members, look what they did 2 years ago. You were gracious, Mr. Representative Chair Garofalo, and you said we. But it wasn't you. It was the Democrats. The Democrats, I think you said we. You might want to correct that.
That is correct. I meant Garofalo.
Yes. Yes, and that's what I want to clarify, too, because Mr. Chair, and I want to clarify that, too, because there's a fundamental, you know, philosophical disagreement here, and it should be clear to citizens who watch us on TV or report on us or follow us that we didn't all do the same thing. Absolutely. The Democrats were, their goal was basically the result of this report. Fundamentally, Minnesotans know that Minnesotans pay a higher percentage of their income, the overwhelming majority of folks, in taxes, in all taxes, than the wealthiest Minnesotans. That's still the case. The report still shows it, but we finally moved the dial. And it did take a big move, as you listen to Dr. Wilson. You have to do pretty dramatic things to move the dial in taxes if you want to address progressivity. And so, yep, we raised taxes. Absolutely. And I think members may think that Democrats regret that or are ashamed of that, and we're not. We don't. We would do it again. It was the right thing. And this report shows it. 90% of Minnesotans see lower effective tax rates overall because of the tax bill that passed. And why is that? If you want to look at one tax, like the income, and I can see members are trying to search for information to refute this, what the facts are, you have to look at the total package. And the total package is that for 90% of Minnesotans, more than that, effective tax rates went down. And that is because we made a decision to do a dramatic increase in property tax refunds for the overwhelming majority of Minnesotans. We didn't raise taxes on everything, contrary to what people say. We raised taxes on the top 2% of earners in Minnesota. And we raised a cigarette tax to cut health care costs. And by the way, that tax, Mr. Chair, still doesn't begin to cover the health care costs that we all pay in government to make up for the use of that product. So, you know, I just want to go on record, Mr. Chair, and let folks know that if anyone thinks that people are regretting that tax increase, you know, I don't know of anybody on my side of the aisle who is. We're out of a deficit. We paid back the schools. We got rid of almost all the shifts and gimmicks. And while the Department of Revenue isn't here to have an opinion on, you know, one team or the other, this should tell members you can fundamentally disagree with it. And I get that people disagree with it. But if you were wondering what we were trying to do, this is it. We were trying to move the dial on who pays. And we absolutely succeeded. Absolutely. We now have the wealthiest paying a little bit more and everyone else paying a little bit less. That was our goal. So, you know, I certainly know that this committee, Mr. Chair, and with the surplus you have, you can undo that. And I fully expect that the omnibus tax bill is going to repeal the fourth tier. If people are true to their concerns, we'll look forward to seeing you have it there. You certainly have the money in the surplus. You can go back to the way it was. You can have the rich pay even less and everyone else pay more again. Go ahead. Repeal the fourth tier. Let people see that you're proud of the positions you took 2 years ago, because we're proud of our positions. And, you know, I'm not trying to be hostile or combative, but I have watched from January, February, March that people, you know, are asserting around the Capitol that, you know, maybe Democrats aren't sure about what they did. We're sure. This shows it. And when we see the omnibus tax bill, I suppose, in about 4 weeks, we'll see if there's a fourth-tier repeal. If not, that says that, indeed, the new majority confirms that was the right thing to do. And if there's a cigarette tax repeal, we'll see that, too. So, you know, I just want to say that different parties have different positions about their goals, and one of the fundamental goals we have, Mr. Chair, and Representative Garofalo is right, there are other things to think about: volatility, stability, adequacy. There's all kinds of things, horizontal equity, vertical equity. We set out to address incidents, progressivity, and it was achieved. Now, I have no doubt that there may be a beginning of an unraveling of that by the end of this year, but I do want, my question is, Mr. Chair, is to ask Dr. Wilson, you know, how would the 2017 projection on progressivity on the incidents, how would it look different if based on the February forecast as opposed to the November forecast? Can you project? Because this is already out of date. You know, this is up to November. So could Dr. Wilson, could you tell us, could you project what we might see if we were able to include the February forecast?
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Nicheski, we sometimes do that. We can do that. It's updating only the 2017 portion of the study. When there's a large change in the forecast, we have often done that in the past. I can't project what the results would be. I can't really guess what the results would be. Usually they don't change much unless there's been a huge change in the forecast. So my guess is it would not be would not be very large, but it doesn't have to be very large to change some of the results of the study, so the differences. So that is something that, again, we've done in the past. I'm not necessarily offering to do it, but we're willing to do it if it's requested. So it's that is one of the problems, given the date that this is due. And again, we were a week late already this time, but given the date it's due, there's no way to bring in the February forecast. In fact, even now, February forecast, still trouble getting some of the numbers we need to do the updates now, given we need the consolidated funds report. We need certain things that are not available right away. So, but again, that's something that is potentially possible.
Thank
you, Mr. Chair. And just one last question. Dr. Wilson, and this, you know, just looking, I was looking at the tables of other states' indexes at their suits index, and they're just one number for the whole state. But can you just maybe opine, and I listened carefully, part of the improvement in the progressivity is this, the growth in income in addition to law changes, so it's both. But you know, it seems to me that the states that tend to have the most progressive income taxes, and you know, Minnesota's way up there now, we're in the top four or five. I know people always cite it to us, it's four or five, something like that. Aren't they also the states that tend to have the highest incomes? I mean, what comes to mind to me is California and New York has an income tax on the actual city, and Hawaii. And I think what we share, even though it's maybe a ranking people don't like to hear, is we have very high per capita incomes. Is that an accurate statement as a group, or maybe it's not a fair question to you, but maybe it's to Mr. Michael. But you know, when we look at the charts you have in here, and I was looking at page 74, it's just an incidence, one number by the state, and I, you know, that's all earners. And I'm trying to understand just top earners, because that's really been the criticism, I think, of the past 2 years, that we raised taxes on the wealthiest Minnesotans, and I think it correlates with high income.
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nogueski, we can look at that, but I don't have a ready answer. If you look at the list, you've got Maine up toward the top. It's a little hard to know what it would be, but we could look at it.
Just a comment on one of your comments, Chair Nogueski. You mentioned that in the when we present the tax bill, the omnibus tax bill, that if Republicans don't try to repeal the fourth tier, that means they must be in love with it. There's really nothing further from the truth, and we haven't made those decisions yet. But if it's not in there, it doesn't mean we don't love it. It just means that the chairman wants to get a tax bill signed and understands that the governor, with his premier piece of legislation from 2 years ago, probably ain't going to sign the bill. And so I'm taking members, just so you know, a very pragmatic report, being very pragmatic in my approach, because I want a tax bill signed with the governor. And to go out there and say we're going to stick a thumb in your eye and get rid of the fourth tier probably isn't the best way to give peace a chance. And so just because the fourth tier wouldn't be in the bill certainly doesn't mean we love it. Just Chair Lincheski.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I can certainly appreciate that. You know, I'm proud of the fact that I got Governor Pawlenty to sign many of my tax bills. But, you know, often first we proposed our principles and values, and he said no, we got that. And then we came back to the table, didn't shut down government, and actually passed tax bills that Governor Pawlenty signed and Governor Dayton signed. So I understand that. At some point, though, you know, the lack of bill introductions even to demonstrate the chagrin, I guess, with our action to me is interesting, and I guess what you're signaling to me is it'll be the minority's responsibility to make sure you all get to take a vote on that. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
And I'm sure we'll have many opportunities, Carolyn Chesty. And with that being said, just so members know, I mean, I could play the political cards and I could, you know, do all the stuff that would be in Greg David's perfect world, but I understand Greg David's perfect world isn't going to get signed into law. So I'm thinking about skipping one step and actually working on a bill that could be signed. But we'll see. We'll see how it all plays out. Thank you, Chair Lincheski. Chair Earhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just sitting here thinking about this, and I remembered that the four previous Republican governors raised taxes. Lavender started the sales tax. Cui put an income tax surcharge on the incomes of the state. Governor Carlson raised the sales tax, and Parenti Blush had the health impact fee, which was in $407 million a year. Now, Governor Dayton has had his go at it this past session, but here's my request for Dr. Wilson. As I look at the effective tax rates for 2012 on page 10, we see that the about the ninth decile effective tax rate starts to fall off at over 141,010.5, over 202,010.2, and over 494,9.8%. So my request to you is please don't show this page to the governor or we're going to be in trouble again.
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative Earhart, I promise I won't show it to the governor, but I have a feeling he'll see it. I would say that numbers you were quoting, though, were for 2012, so you don't see the same pattern in 2017, so maybe you're not going to be in trouble after all.
Chair Earhart?
Nothing.
And members, when I said poke a thumb in the governor's eye, that was politically speaking, of course. I would never advocate violence in any way. Okay, with that, Chair Garofalo.
Well, I don't want to prolong the debate, Mr. Chairman, but it's in response to my friend, Representative Lincheski. She said two things that kind of caught my eye. One is that you Democrats didn't regret what they did. And I would disagree with you, Representative Lincheski, because it wasn't less than a year later you came back and you repealed some of those tax increases in 2014. So I think there was some regret, at least for some of the tax increases you passed. But so I think that would be a fair statement. But also, make no mistake about it, we're talking about a smaller amount of people paying taxes, and that's fine, but you have the consequences of the last 2 years were to introduce unprecedented lack of stability, a lack of predictability, and lack of reliability in our tax code. That's what's happening. And so, well, it's not a matter of what we see. We have a smaller base of people paying a disproportional amount of taxes. Now, the good news is you get to say that a small, unpopular minority in our society are paying for the government services, everyone. That's the positive trade-off from a messaging perspective. But from a mathematical standpoint, we now have a very small sliver of our state providing a huge percentage of the revenue. And the good news is when things go better, we get to rise fast. But when things slow, and they unavoidably will slow, we will feel it harder than other states. That's not ideology, that's not perspective, that's math. So as long as everyone understands that maybe, you know, the next time there's a recession and we feel these revenue hits hitting us harder, maybe Democrats will take a different perspective on it. But then again, maybe they'll just come back and propose tax increases on the middle class. So we'll find out and see.
Did he say Lincheski?
No. Did I?
No, nope, just my friend.
Okay. Okay. Okay, let's go on. Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, the word chagrin was mentioned by the chair over there on the other side, and being St. Patrick's Day, got my Irish up. Certainly what you said was true, Representative Lincheski, who's Irish too. Old Lincheski or Mick Lincheski? Well, I knew I liked you anyway. We're proud of what we did. We moved the dial on who pays. Yeah, you're correct. But also you should add what you did as well. You moved the dial on who pays. We all pay more at the grocery store, at our restaurants, at our pubs, and so on and so forth. Because of the minimum wage increase, because of the MNsure, because of the tax, the health care increase, we all pay more. My folks in Wright County, their businesses and families are paying 25 to 45% in health care. My grocery store has to pay more. My local restaurants in my area, who, yes, they talk to me when I go out and see them. They, too, have raised prices because the minimum wage and the effects of the Democrats, what they did the last 2 years. So, you know, you did move the dial, and we all will pay more. And everything we purchase, for the most part, and consume, we all will pay more. And in time, the businesses will continue to suffer, lay off people, as I'm being told in Wright County. I'm sure I'm not an anomaly. I'm sure it's happened in other districts. But they're laying off people. They're cutting back on hours because simply, especially when it comes to the restaurant hospitality industry, they are on very slim margins. Your mom and pop restaurants are struggling. And you moved the dial all right, and to the point where the dial and the door will be closed So don't forget to mention that as you opine on how good you did in moving the dial in Minnesota in the last 2 years.
Thank you. Dr. Wilson, next time you do this, maybe don't make it quite so controversial. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I've heard a lot of discussions about philosophical differences and so forth, but I think we all need to remind ourselves that we're all in it for the same reason. We want to do what's best for the state and where we want to go. And we also need to remind ourselves that oftentimes whenever we go on a journey, there's more than one pathway to get there. One may be more direct and one may be more enlightening, etc. But we certainly get there in different directions. And so the key about what I've heard is that tax policy the last few years was driven to help the incidence report go down, or the tax incidence. So my question is, the 2012 to 2017 change is a five-year change, whereas all the rest on page 25 of the chart, you'll notice that they're all in two-year spots. And I noticed that from 2010 to 2012, we had a 0.005 change in that change. And for the next 5 years, from 12 to 17, if you do that for 2 years, I think it's about a 0.008, which isn't a lot different. But I think the policies of the taxes and so forth were certainly different between those sessions. What caused the reduction in that incidence from 2010 and 2012?
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterberg, I must admit we have spent much more time trying to figure out what happened between 12 and 17 and here, because I knew that's where all the questions are coming from. The change from 10 to 12, you were coming out of a recession. As was mentioned earlier, this was a year with very high capital gains, which should have moved the other direction in terms of the way things were going. There have been some instances where I actually tried to figure out what happened over the 2 years, but I really haven't gone into to look at that very carefully. We know that, you know, property taxes were fairly controlled. I think most of it is just simply the economy. In that case, I think that we're speeding up growth. Income inequality is certainly. You know, we have information here about the income distribution in the study as well. Income inequality changes can drive a lot, and so that's changing as well. But there were not big policy changes. It was really coming out of the recession and going into 12. There's not much else going on than just economic growth to drive things. It's really hard to point to any policy at the state level that made a big difference.
Representative Petersburg.
Well, Mr. Chair, if I could follow up, because I think I heard your testimony earlier saying that as the economy grows and it grows above what inflation is, that you tend to have it tends to move towards progressiveness, and because of that, just statement that you said, there would at least be, in my opinion, implication that that trend would have continued on even without any additional policy changes. And so I'm wondering how that might have factored into just the fact that the economy was starting to grow, and whether or not we could have accomplished at least some of this without those policy changes. And I would be curious to know your view.
Dr. Wilson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Peterberg, the relationship between, I've struggled to try to look at these in the past, and what we find is the years of greatest growth, 1998, 2000, were boom years. Those were years of very high, very regressive suits indexes for those 2 years. 2002 was a recession, and yet the suits index was very low that year, very close to zero. So a recession may, in fact, make the suits look less regressive. A boom year can make it look more regressive. It's difficult to figure out what is driving what in these patterns. The odd thing was in 2010, I expected in 2010 the same thing as 2002. I expected the suits index to drop in 2010 because of the recession. But it was a very different recession in 2010 than 2002. And the way it hit homes, the way it hit different things, it just wasn't the same kind of recession, and it was completely different behavior in 10, so we didn't get the increased equality in 10 that we would expect it to in reduced regressive that I would have expected in a recession. And so you've got sort of a weird 10, you've got a weird 12, and to be honest, I can't sort out what was driving things. I do know that if you look from 12 to 17, if you take those law changes out, I don't see much change. So could we have gotten to the same place, and could we have seen a further change between 12 and 17? I don't see much evidence in the data for that at all, because other than, you know, if you take out those law changes, you don't see much change at all. You see us about where we were, or maybe even slightly more regressive. So I may not be answering your question. I'm struggling, obviously, but the argument that somehow if you don't raise taxes, you don't put the fourth tier in, something else had to give, it's a little unclear how you even model what would happen instead. But you just sort of say, well, what if we just took those tax changes out and didn't do them? If that's all you do, and you assume it doesn't affect anything else, then you would not move toward less regressivity. You'd move, if anything, toward more compared to 2012.
Thank you, Dr. Wilson, and I think that kind of, again, makes it the reason why it's so difficult to predict some of these things, because just as you said, there's no way of really knowing why 2010 to 2012 has occurred, and your projections through 17 are simply projections and nothing until we actually get the data in. It does seem like we're looking at just kind of the best case scenario based upon past experience, which again, from 2010 to 2012, doesn't fit the anomaly. So, you know, it's hard for us to really say that these particular policies had that impact, because there are other factors, as you clearly stated, that were impacting it. And so, again, it's always easier to deal with past history and data and try to figure that out. But it sounds like even in this case, it's difficult to know why. So thank you for that. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. Representative Moline. Okay, we'll put her on the list down here. Dr. Wilson, on page 21, and it's been referred to several times, there's a, we talk about incomes going up from 12 to 17 to 25%. That seems a little generous to me. That seems kind of high. Where did they get that from, or how did they come to that conclusion?
Mr. Chair, the way this study is done, we use the income tax sample as our starting point. So we're using, you know, the HITS model grows things out to 2019 now. So we're using the HITS model growth rates from the House income tax sample, income tax model, simulation model. But anyway, we're using the growth rates that are set in there by MMB as part of the forecast. So the forecast increase in income is basically driven by the economic forecast. That was November forecast, not February forecast. But it's the growth. We sort of know where we were in 12, and it's what's being forecast. So if that's overstating growth, then all the growth in the forecast is overstated, and your budget decisions being made on the rate of growth are overstated. So, basically, that's what we're doing. We're just using the forecast, and it's as valid as the forecast is.
I mean, I hope those numbers turn out. That would be quite awesome. Now, in that 25% increase, is there a breakdown per decile? Is maybe the 10th decile maybe 37% and the third decile 21%? Or is there a breakdown there?
Mr. Chair, the differences between deciles are, it's fairly consistent, but that's partly because of the way the modeling is done between 12. The projections are using growth rates from the HITS model. So we do grow wages at a different rate than we grow capital gains, and we grow capital gains at a different rate than we grow interest income. But given the way that is, you don't tend to get greatly differential unless you had some forecast of very great changes in, say, capital gains. So they're fairly equal. Between 2010 and 2012, though, the top decile's income grew twice as fast as the other nine. And again, that's partly because the capital gains realizations are being counted in there. But so you do see those patterns where income can grow very much differently. We do see slightly higher growth in the projections for 2017 for the top decile than for the others, but it's not anything that's noticeable. It's just slightly greater.
Okay, and members, we will be shutting down at 12 o'clock because we do have floor session at 12:15, so just so we kind of know where we're at. Chair Dabney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think you actually asked the question I was intending to, trying to understand that projection in income, and it does sound like a significant portion of it, Dr. Wilson, if I may, Mr. Chair, is things like stock options and performance bonuses and things that we're more likely going to find isolated at the top decile or even the top of the top decile, that it's not equally spread across all 10 or even the top 9 deciles, since you've taught me not to pay attention to the bottom one.
Mr. Chair, Representative
Dr. Wilson,
I think if you look at the 2017, these projections are pretty much across the board in terms of growth. But again, it's partly because of the way the forecast is done. But it's not based on bonuses or things. That may have been true in 12 a little bit more, but between 12 and 17, that's not what's driving things. So incomes are going up. I would say the 25% increase in income, remember, is you have 5% population growth about, and you have 7% inflation. So you're really talking about a 10% increase in real income over 5 years, which is 2% per year. So 25% sounds really big, but after you take inflation and population growth out, it's not quite as impressive. It's still solid growth. I mean, it is high growth, but it's not. The 25% really rings out as wow, and it's not quite that impressive.
Chair Dabney.
Mr. Chair, thank you, Dr. Wilson. Yeah, you know, I've been at this job 15 years and haven't gotten a raise yet. So that 25% did kind of stand out. So you made me, I think, understand something I didn't before. That 25% increase is not, I'm going to get 25% increase. That is with whatever increase people might get in their job, inflation and population, the state as a whole is going to see a 25% increase. But individuals, the projection is more in the 10% range. Am I understanding that correctly?
Well, Dr. Wilson, I personally am hoping for more than 25%, but to the Dabney question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dabney, the 10% is the increase above inflation. So if you sort of say you expect 10% above inflation, you'd be right. But it is 10% above inflation, so you still got to be 17 if you added the inflation back in.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Wilson. That's helpful. That's insightful. Mr. Chair, one of your members lamented the actions of this committee and under the previous leadership and talked about how damaging it was to particularly the hospitality industry. I'd just like to remind members that the Minnesota Restaurant Association anticipates a 6.6% job growth in their industry. That doesn't sound like struggling to me. Right now I'd take a 6.6% increase in my income here, and I'd be awfully pleased. Unemployment is now the lowest it's been in Minnesota since 2001. Not exactly a struggling economy crushed by overburdensome taxes. The last 4 months of 14, we're now at a point with fewer unemployed people in the state than there are job openings. And the increase specifically in hotel and restaurant jobs in that time period was the largest seen on record. So I just thought I'd correct the record there so that we all understood the robust, particularly hotel and restaurant economy that we have right now and the jobs they're providing. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chair Dabney, just to correct one thing, one of our members. We are the tax committee. We are the world.
Mr. Chair, an unnamed.
And thank you for that. That was noted. Thank you very much. I have Anderson S., Loeffler, Drazkowski, Knobloch. Chair Anderson S.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of the hour, I'll be brief. You know, it was mentioned earlier today that, you know, Minnesota's personal growth is great, but when you actually compare it to the states that are listed in the study with Florida, with Texas, with Washington, Minnesota is underperforming all of the income growth from those states. In fact, we're underperforming the U.S. when it comes to income growth as a percentage. So I think that we need to be mindful of that, that's, I think, a little disconcerting when we're looking at the future, that our income growth is below those states and also below the national average. So,
Dr. Wilson, any thoughts on that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Anderson, I don't really have a response to that.
Okay. Thank you, Chair Anderson. So, Representative Loeffler? Representative Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Senator Drazkowski?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Wilson, I was tracking pretty consistently with Representative Garofalo when he was here about concentrating the state's tax burden on more and more, on less and less people, especially the income tax. What happens, you know, we have seen that in each of our districts after this, you know, tax on the rich was done in Minnesota, we've seen people, I think we've all had neighbors and friends that have left the state, and some of them, a number of them, have fallen into this area. And I think there's an understanding that some people have fled the state because of this, that are in those upper income brackets that are paying that large portion of the income tax that Representative Garofalo talked about. So when they leave, and if they continue to leave, they will leave their tax burden on the rest of the people that remain. So my question is, which of the remaining deciles then are the ones that are going to receive the greatest proportion of that tax burden?
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think it depends on the decision that you make as a tax committee, because if that happens, then you'd be making law changes to try to change things. It wouldn't automatically shift. If taxes went down, they could go down automatically, but the shift would have to take some action by this committee.
So, Mr. Chair, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Wilson, in the absence of this committee or the legislature making any changes, if the 10th decile just all went away, if they all moved to Tennessee tomorrow, and that income that they pay was distributed to the other 9 deciles, which ones would pay a greater amount as a percentage of their income?
Dr. Wilson?
Mr. Chair, Representative, if we distribute the income equally to each of the other 9?
Well, Mr. Chair, and Mr. Wilson, I mean, the other 9 deciles are going to continue to be here under the right. Huge government we have in the state and have to pay for it, right? I mean, we're still going to have, you know, $77 billion all funds budget or whatever that number is today. So which of the deciles that remain that didn't move to Tennessee, that stayed here, which of them is going to pay more than as a share or as a percentage of their income? Which of them is going to pay the most because of the added burden that they've been giving because the now Tennessee volunteers are no longer here volunteering.
Dr. Wilson, wouldn't that be equal? I mean, they'd all go up?
Mr. Chair, if again, you'd have the only, if 10% of the population left, you'd have all kinds of things happen. So you might have job changes, you might have home prices change, you might have all kinds of things happen. But if you don't, if you just assume that away, just assume that the people are still here and they still got the same income and they still got, presumably they would be paying the same taxes they are now, and it would be the budget deficit that you'd have, and then somehow you got to change the tax law in order to get more revenue to cover the cost of government. And if you raise that by raising the sales tax, then it would be more, then the rate would be higher at the bottom. If you did that by increasing the home property taxes, presumably it would not be property taxes because it's local government. If you did it by cutting local government aid or something, you might increase property taxes. All we know is that there'd be a hole, but how that hole gets filled would be something that would depend completely on what was done to try to fill the hole.
Thank you.
Chair Drazkowski. Members, we do have floor session 12:15. I have Chair Knobloch and Chair Carlson on the list, so if you could maybe take your questions to Dr. Wilson offline, and I apologize for not getting to you. With that, and I would like to echo Chair Lincheski's comments, and Dr. Wilson, thank you. Thank you for the work you and your staff have done here, and I think that we can all learn a lot from it. So with that, we need to get to the floor. Don't stop believing good government all the time. We are adjourned.